cancer rehab for ambulatory older adults. The most common cancer for women are breast cancer, lung cancer, colorectal cancer. In men, it's prostate cancer, and then also lung and colorectal cancer. The long-term effects of cancer, and probably of treatment too, are cardiac toxicity, neuropathy, and functional decline. Our goal when we're working for working with people with cancer is to decrease the recurrence of other cancers, improve physiological and their psychological ability to withstand the current and future treatments. It's important to know that oxygen is a radiosensitizer, therefore helps destroy cancer cells, and you would want to work them at 30 to 60% of their aerobic capacity. Important questions to ask when you're obtaining a history is get their meds, their side effects of treatments, their previous history of exercise, and their goals. Fatigue is the most common and distressing side effect of cancer, and exercise decreases fatigue and increases physical function. For breast cancer, they use Adriamycin, and then cyclophosphamide, and also SERMs, which are selective estrogen response modifiers, I can say that, and hormones. And they also use aromatase inhibitors, which block estrogen production, and all of those lead to accelerated aging. For prostate cancer, they use androgen blocking agents and anti-androgen therapy. And then their risk of fracture goes up, I would assume, because of the androgen deprivation and also osteoporosis. For lung cancer, non-small cell lung cancer is 80% of those patients. And they use cisplatin and etoposide, and those are epidermal growth factor inhibitors, and there's lower survival rates with lung cancer. Colorectal cancer, they either go for chemo, they either go full FOX or full fury, and they use also 5-FU. If you have a higher age, you have decreased function and increased comorbidities. And you would want to stop exercise if they have a hernia or an infection in their ostomy. For Hodgkin's lymphoma, that comes on in late adulthood. And you would use the Stanford 5 regimen, ABVD, and use monoclonal antibodies. For non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, you would want to learn or use alkylating and steroids. The byproducts or the response for both type of lymphomas is fatigue, and you're not returning to pre-diagnosis ability levels. For leukemia, there is acute myeloid leukemia, AML, and with chemo, you're going to have chemo, so therefore you're going to have stem cells, which actually decrease function and also your cognitive status. I'm trying to read my notes here. You also have an increase in physical activity participation, and also higher levels of participation restrictions in physical activity, I think. Chronic myeloid leukemia, same as above. The one you need to, for older adults, the most common is chronic lymphocytic leukemia, CLL. And there's the regimens on those are the CD20 and the CD52. For melanoma, they're going to have surgery. And after that, they'll do immunotherapy stimulants. And due to that, they'll have physical reactions, also limb stiffness, and decrease in the limb function and increase in edema. Common concerns with any cancer patient is increased infection risk and increased fatigue, decreased balance, and then also lymphedema. For lymphedema and exercise, just progress them slowly with resistance. And then we would exercise ideally starting at diagnosis. Cardiopulmonary issues following cancer treatment, this idea of accelerated aging. So that means the accelerated aging is usually a consequence of inactivity during treatment. On top of that, for breast cancer, concerns with increased lymphedema, or we would be concerned if they have an increase in lymphedema, an infection in the affected limb, and then also they have an elevated risk of fracture due to the osteoporosis. We'd want to refer them back to oncology if they have a persistent cough, pinpoint pain, new edema, a lymphedema flare, unintentional weight loss, night sweats, or cord compression. Remote history of cancer in the older adult, central nervous system cancer and bone cancer are greatest risk for physical impairment. Late effects may present months or years after treatment. Cardiotoxicity is damage to the heart muscle, and if it's severe, it progresses to cardiomyopathy. Risk factors pair, risk factors for heart failure. Those with Hodgkin's lymphoma are 2.5 times greater risk for heart disease. In terms of trying to limit your risk of cancer, you want to have antioxidants, vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin E, selenium, and phytonutrients from plants. Dietary supplements for cancer survivors include vitamin D, omega-3, probiotics, and calcium. It looks like excess insulin can promote tumor growth. And there's a lot of cancer patients that end up developing anemia from either iron deficiency, myelosuppression, tumor in your bone marrow. In addition to that, they'll have decreased sleep, decreased activity, and polypharmacy. So this is hospice, palliative care. I'm just going to lump them all together. So a person will qualify For hospice if their prognosis is of 6 months or less to live. You're going to do two initial cert periods and then unlimited 60-day certs after that. And the patient can revoke that agreement at any time. And their agreement is that they're not going to pursue treatment for the underlying cause of that decline. The goals are to improve function, safety, and comfort. So a lot of what we do there is doing equipment and modifying the environment, training the caregivers, giving them a home exercise program. A lot of times you're going to document with words such as maximize or achieve safe, dot, 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 or knowledgeable in, dot, dot, dot. What we're trying to do is decrease the need for a home aid and decrease the likelihood of them having a disaster while they're at home. 52% of adults, older adults, have chronic pain. And there's a cognitive shift during fear, and that leads to threat perception. A lot of times, they also insulate themselves from others. There's also a bi-directional relationship with disordered sleep and increased inflammation. Palliative care is the broader term. And then within palliative care, you have end-of-life care. And then within end-of-life care, you have hospice, which is the most narrow of that. It's covered by Medicare, Medicaid, and Medicare will cover end-of-life issues. There's three models for rehab in this setting. First is rehab in reverse. The second one is rehab light, and the third one is case management. So for rehab in reverse, they're going to have new issues, new goals, as they progress. They might need new equipment with that decline, and we'll probably also have to vary the frequency as well. We're talking about late stage neurodegenerative diseases, MS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and ALS symptoms. All of them have fatigue and pain. And the end of the disease is that leads them towards respiratory failure, aspiration pneumonia, and eventually they'll go septic. Late stage dementia features. Obviously, their cognitive function will further decline, as well as their communication ability, and they'll also decrease their ability to sustain nutrition. For Parkinson's disease, Honan-Yahr, stage one is unilateral involvement. Stage two is bilateral involvement without balance impairments. Three is mild to moderate bilateral disease and some postural instability. Four is severe disability, but they're still able to walk and stand unassisted. And then finally, stage five is that they're wheelchair bound unless they have an aid there. With MS, there's two types. The relapse remit, 85 to 90% of people are there initially. And then they go into secondary progressive in the first 10 to 20 years. ALS is a progressive degeneration of the upper motor and the lower motor neurons of the cortex, medulla, and the anterior horn cells. It begins in the limbs and progresses to the lungs. The life expectancy is 2 to 5 years. legal and ethical issues in geriatric rehab. Altruism is the unselfish concern for a patient's welfare. ADA is a requirement for all businesses greater than 15 employees. You must be able to fulfill the job requirement with reasonable accommodation. You are at risk for liability cases with negligence, intentional misconduct, breach of the therapeutic promise, injury from defective equipment, and abnormally dangerous activities. For HIPAA, it applies to everything besides TPO, treatment, payment, and operations, and now also law enforcement. So, TOPL. T-O-P-L. Elder abuse, some of the things that would qualify are restraints, either physical or chemical. For neglect, you can see that in their hazards, and then, neglect, you can see it in their hygiene, and also the, in addition to that, it's the failure to protect the elder from hazards. Warning signs for elder abuse are dehydration, scratches or pinch marks, withdrawal, hesitancy to speak freely, anger. Caregiver will speak for the resident, and you're going to restrict contact with other people. Also, successful aging is the absence of disease with continued good cognitive and physical function, whereas optimal aging is function across many domains to the patient's satisfaction. Physiology of wound healing. So there's three phases: the inflammatory phase, the proliferation phase, and the remodeling phase. First, for the inflammatory phase, you're going to see a change in color, temperature, turgor, and sensation. And the goal of all of those is to produce a clean wound bed. So what's going to happen first is you're going to have a vasoconstriction in the area, which is going to lead to a hypoxic state, which will secrete some signaling chemicals, and then over time that will result in increased perfusion. During the proliferation phase, first of all, that overlaps a lot with the inflammation stage, and that's going to be, this proliferation is going to be signaled by the hypoxia and the lactate that's coming from that wound. As you have proliferation, we're going to restore through epithelialization and collagen synthesis. And for remodeling, we're trying to balance the collagen synthesis and the lysis that's going on in the area also. Type 3 collagen is going to be replaced by type 1 collagen. For chronic wounds, we're going to have a decrease in blood flow, and which is going to lead to ischemic tissue, and both of those will lead to inflammation. With proliferation, all that first part was the inflammatory phase. The proliferation phase, most often they lack moisture and oxygen, and the wound beds, the wound edges have rolled up, so that's what's preventing them from coming across and epithelialize. That if they have a chronic wound, some of the other things could be playing in to it is inadequate protein, inadequate zinc, vitamin C. And then for the remodeling phase, a lot of times that's a keloid response for a chronic wound. For pressure ulcers, five stages. First stage, intact skin, and there's an observable alteration. Number two is a partial thickness wound, which is where both the epidermis and the dermis have been compromised, and there's no eschar or slough. Three is full thickness, so it goes up to the fascia, but not through the fascia. And then stage four is a full thickness. So yeah, four stages of pressure ulcers. Stage four is full thickness. There's damage to the muscle, tendon, or bone. And again, that is through the fascia if you go stage four. Those wounds that are unstable is when you have an eschar or necrosis, which doesn't allow you to determine the depth. Wound drainages. So there's sanguineous, which is thin and also red-tinged. Serosanguineous is pink and it's normal. Serous fluid is clear and normal. And seropurulent is cloudy and yellow. And a lot of times with that, that means that there's an impending infection. And then purulent is yellow, and there's definitely infection. Pseudomonas is sweet and thick. I can't read that one. Wound infection from a system or systemic signs is if there's an infection, there'll be an increase in temperature, increased whites, confusion, and they're also going to have red streaks in the area. Local signs of a wound infection are redness, heat, edema, pain, and exudate. Okay, wound management. So the first thing we need is a clean wound. So enzymatic debridement is selective. It's inappropriate with dry gangrene and ischemic wounds. So the next one up is autolytic debridement. That's also selective. It is a film, and that's for dry eschar. Hydrogels are best for necrotic and dry wounds. Hydrocolloids are the only ones that are indicated for moist wounds, and then also with necrosis. So with the three autolytics, they're contraindicated if there's an infections. That you have 2 weeks without any progress, and lots of unplanned removal. That's when you wouldn't want to use autolytics. The contraindication for VAX is if they have necrosis, untreated osteomyelitis, and a malignancy. The next point is that we need to create the right environment. So using E-stem on chronic wounds, especially pressure ulcers, that's going to decrease the hemorrhage and necrosis, and it's going to increase granulation. It's going to decrease wound exudate, and increase epithelialization and restart the proliferation. The next thing is the ideal in terms of wound dressing is that it needs to be moist, it needs to allow for gas exchange, and it needs to insulate in terms of temperature. So alginates are for moist wounds. They're highly absorptive, and they're non-adherent. Foams can be used primary or secondary dressings. Also for moist wounds, they're also highly absorptive, breathable, and non-adherent. Hydrogels are 3D structures. They're hydrophilic. They're a moisture donor. Can be used for autolytic debridement. They're non-adherent and absorptive. Films are impermeable to moisture, and they're secondary in terms of dressing. They're also for moist. They can be autolytic debridement. They're good for protection, and they're breathable. Gauze is absorbent, but it doesn't support optimal wound healing. It's uncomfortable, and it also increases the infection risk. For tissue breakdown, that means that the time and the pressure is exceeding the capillary pressure. And it's good to put films on pressure points. When you're doing a risk assessment for wounds, you want to look at the mobility, the moisture, friction, their smoking status, and the stresses on the tissue. There are two scales for assessing risk for a pressure ulcer. First is the Braden scale. It's a 6 to 23 scale. Higher is better, and the cut score is 18. There's also a Norton scale, which is a 5 to 20 scale. Higher is better, and 12 is the cut point for a high risk. That's it. Diet and exercise considerations on cardiopulmonary disease. For COPD, you want to make sure you have enough vitamin C, vitamin E, and omega-3s to keep the lungs healthy. And that's going to increase their elasticity, increase their oxygen, and increase circulation. And from a nutrition standpoint, you want to make sure that you give them adequate energy. You want to prevent weight loss, and you're preventing the loss of fat-free mass, and improve their pulmonary status and increase their weight. Carbs yield an increase in CO2, and fats decrease the amount of CO2. So you want to have enough to stimulate protein synthesis, which means that you need somewhere between 1.2 to 1.7 grams per kilogram of protein. And for breathing exercise, you want diaphragmatic breathing, segmental breathing, and pursed-lipped breathing. Exercise with the more vigorous, the better. You always want to focus on lower extremities. Utilize supplemental oxygen and mobilize the chest. The importance of exercise to nutrition is that we increase the efficiency of absorption, decrease dyspnea, and then overall well-conditioned muscles use less energy. For cardiac and vascular disease, oxidation of LDLs initiates plaque formation. So you need to be, and then you also need to be sure that they get their B complex, B1, B6, and B12. That's going to increase the nerve conduction velocity and circulation, as well as getting enough zinc, which deals with bone healing, sorry, bone and wound healing. Measuring and improving outcomes in post-acute care. The ones that we need to watch for in terms of readmissions are MIs, heart failure, pneumonia, COPD, total hips, total knees, and CABG. Inpatient rehab facility admits require 3 hours of rehab 5 days per week. They need to be in two therapies and have a reasonable expectation of improvement. Quality measures, also rehospitalization in the first 30 days of a home health stay, or if they have an ED use without an admit. Medicare. For Part A, concurrent minutes are if you're not doing the same thing, but they're line of sight. And so what happens is you treat them and then you divide the minutes by two. And parcel them out that way. Groups are you're having 2 to 4 patients at a time if you're using an aid. Then you can have three. The minutes start at the first activity and ends with treatment. So no bathroom breaks or anything like that. Your reeval time is as part of a treatment process counts. Your setup time counts. Students are direct supervision. For modalities only, setup time is considered skilled. In addition to education time and monitoring, but not just when you're just letting it run. For Rehab Ultra, 720 minutes of rehab a week in two disciplines. Very high is 500 minutes a week in one discipline. And then you're going to assess at 14, 30, 60, and 90 days. For Part B, the things that are not skilled are general exercise for fitness and flexibility. Not covering temporary weakness, and it's also considered skilled to set up a maintenance program. If there's a cognitive impairment, so there's no follow-through, then limited services are covered with good documentation to teach caregiver, unless we're doing like transfers and balance. On to stats. Start with sensitivity and specificity. You're going to use sensitivity to screen, specificity to confirm. Both are on a 0 to 1 scale. So, sensitivity, those who have it. Let me back up. Sensitivity, remember spin and snout. So, sensitivity, you use it to rule it out. And then everything else is flipped. Those who have it test positive, which means that you have the ability to recognize when a condition is present. Therefore, if you have a high sensitivity, you're able to find the true positive because there are few false negatives. For specificity, spin in, you rule it in, high specificity. Everything else is flipped. Those who don't have it test negative. Therefore, if it's a high specificity, you can find the true negative because there are few false positives. For likelihood ratios, a high positive likelihood ratio is 7 to 10. A low or a good negative likelihood ratio is less than 0.2. Doesn't go below 0. An odds ratio, a positive moderate odds ratio is 3, and a large positive odds ratio is 10. For negatives, a moderate negative is 0.7, and a large negative likelihood ratio or odds ratio, these are all odds ratios, sorry, is 0.2. And then the CI confidence interval must not cross 1. Chi-squareds test if the results and the reference standard have no association, but they're unable to say the strength or direction of the relationship, so therefore don't pay as much attention to that. And that's also for parametric data. Kappa is the reliability coefficient for agreement between the examiners for categorical data. Predictive validity deals with prognosis. Discriminative means that you're able to discriminate multiple forms of a disorder. PICO stands for patient, intervention, comparison / control, and outcome. For prognosis, if there's a yes, no, or categorical data, you would do a logistic regression analysis. So that's yes, no, or categorical data. Linear regression establishes where a specific score falls on a continuum. An MCID is the smallest amount of change deemed clinically important to the patient, and that's found by linking a score of an outcome measure to a GROC. The effect size is the magnitude of change or correlation of scores. So an effect size of 0.5 is medium effect, 0.8 is a large effect. Parametric effect is kind of like a parabola, normal distribution. Non-parametric data is no specific distribution. So that's when you want to be more conservative or you're working with a smaller sample. And ANOVA is for parametric data and has greater than 2 samples. Mann-Whitney U is 2 sample, non-parametric data. Positive predictor value is the probability that subjects with a positive screen have the disease.